Welcome to the Tennisworthy podcast. I'm Chris Bowers, and we're taking another look at some of the most instructive moments from the International Tennis Hall of Fame's 2024 series of in-depth interviews with tennis legends. Today we're focusing on the psychology of tennis, which is not solely about psychology, but about dealing with pressure, keeping emotions at the right level, and generally looking after a player's mental health, which is becoming a more high-profile topic given the ultra-competitive nature of the current professional tennis world. The idea of players using psychologists has really only come in over the past 30 to 40 years, and one of the first coaches to recognise the need for some mental and emotional support was the Hall of Famer Nick Bollettieri. Bollettieri hired Jim Lehr to be a source of pastoral support at his academy in Florida. Jim Courier, who went on to win four Grand Slam singles titles and two Davis Cups, recalls the value of having a tennis psychologist at a training centre that had so many aspiring champions.
At Bollettieri's, I was incredibly lucky to have access to Dr. Jim Lehr, one of the first sports psychologists, at least in the United States, still a preeminent voice. And we could go talk to him and get things off of our chest at a time when I don't think that was readily available to many athletes in general.
As the preeminent tennis psychologist, he's obviously helped lots of people. What did he help you with?
Well, first of all, just having someone listen is really important. For mental health has become such a hot button topic now, and it was a taboo back then. It was a sign of weakness. If you talked about needing help mentally, you were indicating quote unquote weakness as an athlete. That's not the case. It's just another area that needs to be nurtured like your lungs and your legs and every other muscle that you need to play tennis. Your fragile ego is something that needs to be nurtured too when you're losing and winning on a daily basis. So Jim was first and foremost a place to go talk about what was happening and have him be real thoughtful about it, give you some feedback on that. But he also helped with dealing with stress on the court by giving a lot of us rituals and systems to deal with stress. So ways to stay focused and not get distracted with everything that was going on around you. So you had a template of what to do in between points that gave you that framework to stay focused.
We got on to Jim Lehr because I asked you about setbacks.
Yes.
So looking back, how did you overcome your setbacks?
There were many ways to overcome them. Sometimes it would be writing thoughts down, keeping journals, and then looking at them a few days later and trying to figure out exactly what it all meant and finding a way to stay motivated. I mean, tennis is a relentless business. Tournaments week in and week out, one winner, you know, many enter, only one leaves undefeated. So you had to learn how to deal with those setbacks. And ultimately, it also came down to having not just people like Jim Lehr around, but also people like Brad Stein and Jose Agueras around, or Craig Boyton, that could help me set goals and understand that I was still trying to get better. It didn't matter what the ranking next to my name was, whether it was a single digit or whether it was triple digits, there's still areas to improve. And that was a way to keep things moving forward and to sort of cushion the blows of some tough defeats that inevitably happen if you play at this level.
Jim Courier highlighting how the psychologist's biggest help could be just listening. And it's interesting to hear him talk about bruised egos. Tennis players need their ego, but that ego must be able to suffer defeats and bounce back. And sometimes outside help is needed for that to happen. Let's hear now from a player who used a psychologist and went on to win Wimbledon and five Fed Cup titles. That's the forerunner of today's Billie Jean King Cup. Conchita Martinez started working with a psychologist just a year before she won Wimbledon, but as she explains here, it formed an important part of a busy schedule in ensuring she was the best player she could be.
I did work with a psychologist, and it really helped a lot. I was probably 21 when I started working with him, and I was on and off because, you know, everything that a professional tennis player has to do is like time, you know, everything is work, and even when you're having a massage, it feels like work, and it should be like, wow, this should be feeling good, but it's work because you're trying to recover. So there's a lot of things that you have to do, and sometimes you feel like, okay, I have it, you know, I'm okay now, I don't need to work as closely with a psychologist. But I think it's very, very important and helped me.
What did you learn most?
I learned a lot of things. I mean, we worked a lot of on a lot of things. We did a lot of relaxation and visualization, and that helped me a lot. We created a plan to follow when I was on the tennis court, when I had a match, some routines that you work out there, and different things, and how to cope with difficult times. And I'm not saying that, you know, working with psychologists, you're going to be able to cope with difficult times and you're going to win every single match, but it's going to probably help you a lot, and I totally recommend it.
When you say that your psychologist helped you with relaxation, does that mean that what you needed was to channel your energies more? Were you a little bit too almost excited?
No, I think I've been a pretty quiet person and not overexcited ever. You know, I was pretty relaxed. I had my nerves, of course, but I wasn't really like panicking before matches or anything. I was quite relaxed. But that helped me out to calm down. Sometimes, you know, I have, you know, he made two different tapes for me that I could listen, you know, one to calm down and one to, like, you know, get in.
Pump yourself up.
Yeah, pump myself up to...
What, before a match?
Before a match. So it was different ways of working. And, yeah, when I went to see him, we always finished with some, you know, like, I don't know, 5-10 minutes where we did relaxation and visualization and stuff like that. And I don't know, it helped me a lot.
And did you visualize just being relaxed on a tennis court, or did you visualize winning matches?
Yeah, sometimes it was related with a tennis court, and sometimes it was like I could find myself on a beach and, you know, just being relaxed there. And sometimes it was with energy, you know, we work a lot with energy, like, you know, you feel every single part of your body, and that helps a lot for your body as well. So different techniques.
So it got you with the right energy to play a tennis match, and it allowed you to sleep well at night.
There you go. Yeah. And I think that's really important. That worked for me. And I know it's probably different now, but, you know, I would totally recommend it.
I suspect it's the same outcome, even if they use different methods.
Yeah. I don't know if, over my years of coaching, I work very closely with psychologists of my players too. And some had different ways of working, totally respectful. For me, you know, it's very important that the player is ready to play every match and is not going to have any distraction, and to have all of the routines that is going to have, you know, help them stay in the moment and just play point by point, you know.
That was Conchita Martinez, clearly an advocate of psychological help, both as a player and as a coach. But what did players do before the advent of sports psychologists? I guess they didn't miss something that hadn't really been invented yet. But we had a fascinating interview with Margaret Court, the woman who picked up 64 Grand Slam titles in singles, women's doubles and mixed. Playing in the 1960s, how did she find the self-belief when mental and emotional challenges cropped up?
I think probably the determination, and people believed in me. I always remember Fred Perry said to me, "Margaret, you should never lose a match. I think you're your own worst enemy often." You know, you had to build yourself. We didn't have psychologists. We didn't have trainers going with us. We had to think for ourselves. And when we did go, we had to go for 10 months of the year. There wasn't the money there to come home. We would be away for a long time overseas. We used to get homesick. But I think it was being away from your nation. You loved your nation. Sort of living out of a suitcase. Back in that time, there was really no money in it. You didn't live in nice hotels and food and, you know, all that. And you had to play every week. I played 3 events nearly every week. I'd play and be in the final on a Sunday, travel on a Monday, and I'd be playing again. And that's all you knew. During tournaments, you didn't get on practice court too much because you're playing too many matches.
Margaret Court talking there largely about the pre-1968 era, when players could only travel if their national association funded them. So she was under instruction from the Australian Association about which championships and tournaments to play. interesting the prominence she gives to others believing in her. Of course, mental strength is a means to an end, not an end in itself. The idea is to win the biggest points and therefore win matches. And that means dealing with nerves and pressure on court in the big matches. The likeable Australian Patrick Rafter played in 4 Grand Slam singles finals, winning 2 and losing 2. So he knows what it's like to be on both sides coming out of the pressure points. Rafter's biggest rivals were Pete Sampras and Andre Agassi. And Rafter acknowledged to Brett Haber that what made those two win 22 major titles between them was the ability to play their best under pressure.
If you look at the top players, Sampras included and Andre, they play the big pressure points really well. And that's what sort of stands them above everyone else as well, believing in their own ability and knowing that they're going to pull off the shot that they need to do. It happens, it doesn't just happen once or twice, it happens, you know, 15 times, 30 times for these guys consistently, and that's why they win, you know, 10, 20, 30 Grand Slams, whatever they're going to win. They're just that good. So I think it goes sort of hand in hand to an extent.
So you bring up the word pressure, which is such an interesting topic. Someone said, well, the greatest, the Federers, the Nadals, the Djokovics, well, they don't feel the pressure. And then I've heard other people say, well, of course, that's not true. Every athlete feels pressure. Mm. They just know how to synthesize it a little bit better. What's your observation about pressure?
I think you summed up really well. That's how I do see it that way, is that they're able to either relieve the expectation of that pressure, or they know how to synthesize it better and put it in its own little box. And it's not that big a deal. But I can tell you that when I played Pete in the finals of Wimbledon and I had him and I choked, that feeling is not a great feeling. And I don't know if Pete ever felt the way I felt, you know, in terms of any of the matches he played, but I felt the pressure so much of the expectation I'm going to win Wimbledon. It was that close. I felt it. So I think they just have a really natural ability to be able to put it in this little box and somehow deal with it. It's a tricky one. We talk about pressure and expectations, and we're seeing it now with, you know, we're seeing a lot now with the players going on with external pressures of life and
mental health.
Mental health, and I don't know. I mean, I'm not. It's really hard for me to sit back and sort of watch it sometimes when I'm going, guys, this is a tennis match. It's not that big a deal. But is there other things in their life going on, which I don't know.
We never know that.
You never know. But in our time, we didn't see it. I don't know. Tennis was never, you had the pressure on the court. Yeah, that's what we get paid for. Mm-hmm. That's what people are seeing and experiencing. If you can't handle it, don't play it.
You realize that you're saying something that's a little bit flying in the face of this evolving thought process of how athletes need to be treated.
I know. But I just got to be, I think you just got to simplify it. First of all, playing a game. It's not the end of the world. It's a bit of fun. Let's not kid ourselves. We're doing something important to save the world. Second of all, we have a crack. Have a go. Let's see how good you are. If you're not that good, no big deal. You know, you're going to find out how good you are, though. That's exciting. That's fun. There's no pressure. Expectation, you're getting paid millions of dollars to do something that's fun. Come on, guys, let's just keep it really real. It is what it is. But if there's other external things going on with mental health, then that's different. But when it comes to tennis and the pressure, that's it. It's always going to be there. Enjoy it. If you're not, don't play the sport.
Those are lovely sentiments from Pat Rafter, but it's clear that some players only play their best when they're taking tennis so seriously it does threaten to affect their mental health. We're back to the need for balance. Take tennis seriously, but not so seriously that it jeopardises mental well-being. Let's finish this look at psychology, pressure and emotions by hearing from one of the most inspiring inductees in the International Tennis Hall of Fame, Esther Vergeer. The Dutch woman was 8 years old when she was paralysed from the waist down, so building herself up to become the world's greatest wheelchair tennis player was a case of believing in herself post-surgery and then believing in herself as an athlete. Even though she ended her career on a 470-match winning streak, yes, that's correct, 470 matches without defeat, Vergeer still had moments of tension and nerves, and she explained to Blair Henley the strategies she developed to overcome them.
I just realized that brain and body is connected in a way that we do not understand as a human being yet, or not fully. But I was aware that it has a connection, because whenever I'm nervous, something happens with my arm or something happens with my pushing the chair. And I didn't want that to happen anymore. So I knew that it had to do with my brain and my mental state. So I was just curious. I was just curious how that would work in general and how that would work for me.
Can you give us an example of whether it was a breathing technique or something that you would visualize before a match or a routine that you had that helped you avoid your arm feeling a little funny or not being able to push the way that you wanted to? Is there anything that comes to mind when you think back?
Well, there's one. Of course, there's a lot of things, and I think the breathing exercise is a totally different aspect than visualization, mm-hmm. for example. What I tell, the next generation athletes is to sometimes just keep it simple because tennis is already a complicated sport.
That's for sure.
And then, I was unbeaten for so long, and there was. In every match, there was this moment that I would become nervous. So it wouldn't matter if I was up 6-2, 4-2. There would be a time within a match that I would become nervous. And that's, of course, an emotion that mm-hmm. comes up. And there was a time that I was trying to fight that emotion and, getting frustrated that it would come up or angry at myself and tell myself not to feel that emotion. And then the mental coach, he said, well, there is no way that you can fight that emotion. You just have to let it be there. And you know that it's going to come. So whenever you feel that it's coming, you have to embrace it and feel that it's there. And then have to distract yourself from that emotion so it would go away and let your focus on your game plan again. So for me, it was an easy tool. But whenever I would feel that emotion, I would give myself a very easy exercise, an easy task to do. For example, the next 10 forehands, I have to hit it, cross court deep, or I would make a placement of the ball. And I would do that, and I would have distracted myself from, the emotion, and then I could focus back on my plan again. So those little exercises or tasks would help me to get back on track, basically.
I love that. I feel like I might use that in my day-to-day life.
Yeah, and again, it sounds so simple, but sometimes that's what you need on a court when the pressure's on, when circumstances are not complete in your control, and then sometimes you need just a simple task.
That tip from Esther Vahea about keeping it simple is one that players at all levels of tennis can adopt. And coming from someone who has overcome such obstacles to reach the absolute pinnacle of her sport, those thoughts carry great gravitas. If you haven't heard the full interview with Esther, please do seek it out on tennisfame.com/podcast, where you'll find all 24 interviews from the first 2 years of these podcasts. Or you can go to your preferred podcast platform and type Tennis Worthy Podcast into the search bar. We'll have more interviews for you in 2025 as part of an extensive and varied package of social and digital media brought to you by the International Tennis Hall of Fame. Make sure you check in regularly so you're constantly up to date with this fascinating range of media. I'm Chris Bowers, thanks for listening, and in these final days of 2024, all of us connected with the Hall of Fame would like to wish you a very happy and successful 2025. Bye-bye.